Okay, here we go. Our first case of the day is Twinhafel v. State Auto Property and Casualty Insurance Company. It is number 084275. And Mr. Hasenstab, you are up.
May it please the court, my name is Dan Hasenstab. I'm arguing for State Auto today. I think one thing me and opposing counsel can agree on in this case is that it really comes down to an interpretation of a three-word phrase in this insurance policy, in the open. And we've given you in our briefs competing views on how that should be interpreted and applied to the facts of this situation. Ours, in essence, is that in the open, in this case, means in the outdoors or in the open air, as was set out in the Victory Peach case, and also looking at the dictionary definition of the case. The opposing counsel wants this to be interpreted as being without any protective covering at all. Actually cites page 16 of his brief, which we believe is an unreasonable interpretation of this phrase, especially in the context of the facts of this case. One reason in support of our interpretation is the actual dictionary definition of the term in the open. As you know, when a policy term is not defined in the policy, the court generally looks to the dictionary definition to get the plain, ordinary, and everyday meaning of a phrase. And when one looks to a dictionary definition of the phrase in the open, it means the outdoors or the open air. There are some other definitions that don't apply, such
as... Let me ask you one question. Yeah. Doesn't at the end of the day, in the open mean unprotected? Here's the reason I'm bringing it up. If you drive by construction sites where they can't move their stuff back and forth, they cover it with heavy tarps and so forth and seal it and so forth and things like that. And that's why I asked the question, isn't really unprotected in the open really synonymous with unprotected? Because you can have a building, a structure, if you made it out of fiberboard, the rain would come right through it, and that would not be considered very substantial. But you also can cover something with tarp, if it's substantial tarp and so forth, and substantially sealed, that would be protected.
I don't think in this, if you look at the facts of this case, that such an interpretation would be applicable here. If we took the definition of in the open to mean protection, and then you're looking at, I mean, there would be a situation where you're looking at the adequacy of the protection. For example, if instead of covering it with tarp, they covered it with newspapers or something, you could say it was protected, but obviously it's not reasonably protected for the risks that were associated with it.
That wouldn't be protected from the rain because the newspaper would leak. But if you had, if you take the protected, what you're saying to is maybe a logical conclusion, if a roof blows off a building, for a period of time, the contents inside that building are unprotected from the rain.
That's true.
So that is not what you intend at all, because then you never pay under the policy. And if something's left right in the middle of the field unprotected, instead of, just laid out in the middle of the field, that would be clearly in the open and unprotected. So I'm saying, is there not a element of the type of protection that is afforded to the what's being covered?
I would agree with you. I believe, like you said, there are these two extremes. One, if you're obviously just sitting in the field with nothing on, I don't think there would be any argument that's in the open. If it's in a sealed building with the roof protected on it, obviously that is not going to be in the open. And what we're dealing with here is situations where we have something other than that, such as a tarp or such as like my example, newspapers or so forth, covering the property.
Isn't the relevant question whether the wood was left exposed to the elements as opposed to whether it was inside or outside of a building?
I don't think that is the main question here, because when you say exposed to the elements, well, even if you take exposed to the elements, what you're taking into account is the adequacy of the protection, which is what I was getting to a minute ago. When you're looking at an area where it's not one of the two extremes that we set out, then you're necessarily going to have to look at the adequacy of the protection here.
But you see, if the real intent of the in the open exclusion is to require the insured to keep personal property indoors, well, then why not say that? As Mr. Twain Hafel points out in his brief, your client did use terms like outdoors and inside a building elsewhere in the policy.
That's true.
So how do we get past that?
Well, what I would posit is that in the open, there could be a reasonable interpretation of in the open that would extend somewhat past just being inside a building, such as, say, a carport. If there was some property that was underneath some type of permanent structure, which was not which the protection was adequate to protect it from rain, snow, sleet, which is the subject of this exclusion, then that...
I think there'd be less protection on a carport where you got sides. Here you've got a tarp covering property. Let me ask you this, taking on some of the questions of my colleagues. I have a hard plastic case that goes on top of my car. I often have my golf clubs in there, and they'll stay there overnight. Can it be said that I've left my clubs in the open in a situation like that?
In that case, I would say no, because that would come back to what you said as far as why we didn't just say indoors or outdoors. In a situation like that, the property is not in the open because the protection that was given to it is adequate to protect it in a reasonable circumstance from rain, snow, sleet. If you put golf clubs in a car, you're not going to expect the car to be tipped over, the roof to be ripped off the car, and the golf clubs to be exposed to the type of risks that are mentioned in this exclusion. On the other hand, when you have the facts of this case, he has I don't know if it's his entire inventory, but a very large inventory, $80,000, according to his affidavit, was stored under just one pile of what was out there. And he puts it under a tarp, which is not connected to any type of permanent structure. He states in his deposition there's holes in the tarp. He has trouble holding the tarp down when the wind blows. So, I mean, you necessarily have to look at the circumstances of this. Was that an adequate protection to keep it free of damage from rain, snow, or sleet?
Another problem, it seems to me, is that the insurance policy here was an open peril or all risk policy, which covered all this risks, unless... And, given the general rule that all ambiguities should normally be construed in favor of the insurance, how do we get past that?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, I think this falls under the exclusion. Second of all, the ambiguity, any ambiguity that would be in here, only a reasonable interpretation of such an ambiguity would be given in favor of insured. And I believe the interpretation that they have posited in this case is not reasonable, especially given the circumstances of what happened here. I'm sorry.
No, I'm sorry.
Okay.
I breathed.
like I was saying earlier, this was, according to his affidavit, $80,000 worth of property that was stored outside, property that apparently would be damaged if it got wet. And the only protection that he gave was putting this tarp over here, which was not fastened to a permanent structure and had holes in it, was blowing around. And also, from his testimony, he kept this under here, it seems to be on a permanent basis. This is unlike the Victory Peach, where there was a hole in the roof and there was a storm coming. They put the tarp on, fastened it to the building as a temporary fix to protect the inside while they fixed the roof.
I thought this property had been out there about 3 or 4 weeks or something like that because he didn't have enough room. He had more product, or at least supplies and he had space for it.
It's actually 3 months, according to his
testimony. Okay, I'm sorry.
There really is no facts as to when he ever intended to move this inside.
Isn't your best argument, though, is not the unprotected issue, but the sufficiency of the covering versus whether it was outside, inside, wherever it was located?
I believe that's part of my argument, the sufficiency of it. The reason I give the positive definition of outdoors is that's the only one that has been applied in a court, any of the case law that we could research, was that they looked at the dictionary definition and they looked at outdoors, and that was the definition that would distinguish Victory Peach from North Texas. I concede that there could
but
be...
As a writer of the policy, though, you sort of had control of how far you wanted to go define different terms.
Correct.
And the term is just in the open.
Correct.
You know, you argued below that there was a fact question as to the extent of the plaintiff's damages, but did you ever argue that his affidavit was insufficient or defective in some way? Or just that given the differences between the affidavit and his deposition testimony, there was a fact?
The affidavit itself was not deficient, per se. My argument on that is that the affidavit would take place of trial testimony. It's given in substitute of what he would testify to at trial. And if he only if we take his affidavit as what he was going to testify to at trial, he's only going to say, he was only going to say what Bradley's property was. He was not going to. There was nothing in the affidavit that showed how he reached that calculation. And in his deposition, he said, "I cannot make a calculation at this time because I need to know how board feet versus linear feet are calculated. Something I don't quite understand." But he said during his deposition he was unable to make a calculation at that time. So how do we get from the fact that I can't make a calculation to here's my calculation? My argument being that if he comes in, that the affidavit is his trial testimony, he can be impeached on the fact that you have not shown us that there is a reasonable basis for you to reach this number. And we could look to your deposition testimony as showing that you didn't know at that time, how do you get to this? So I'm just saying that based on that, there was a fact question in the record that would preclude him from getting summary judgment on damages in this case.
You know, you did not ask for any rebuttal time. Do you want to save some time for rebuttal?
No, I don't, Your Honor.
Okay.
My last issue I would like to talk about the prejudgment interest. The standard for applying prejudgment interest is the damage subject to an easy determination. Counsel implies in his brief that it was... that the damage is indeterminable, which is not the correct standard. Otherwise, you'd award prejudgment interest at any case because at some point it's going to be the damage is going to be determinable. But his own deposition testimony says that it's not an easy determination. He had to didn't know the difference between linear feet, board feet, and so forth. And most importantly, the case law says it has to be determinable at the time of the breach. And his deposition testimony, August of 2007, was almost a year after the damage and 4 months after the complaint was filed. At that point, he still doesn't know what the damages are. So he can't say that there was subject to an easy determination or an easy calculation, which would have warned him prejudgment interest.
Did you have, I'm not sure the record reflects it, but did you have your adjusters go out and look at the damaged property and come up with a... computation as to what that was?
They looked at the property, but once a decision was made that it was not covered under the policy, that they ceased any further valuation efforts at that point. So we do not have an opposing number to put on it.
So you're relying on the deposition testimony and the affidavit to create your conflict.
Correct, Your Honor.
But there's nothing that you've posited yourself or came forward with that says our number would have been $72,000.
No, Your Honor. We're just arguing that the deposition creates a question of fact, and the affidavit is insufficient in showing how he reached that calculation and would subject to him to impeachment at trial. I see my time is up. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Mr. Hendricks, as you come up, don't put his clock on yet. I neglected to say that we are honored today to be joined by Judge Von Bachlin from Indiana. So Judge Evans and I are very pleased to have you with us. Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Scott Hendricks and I represent Roger Twinhoffel, L.E. in this case, and will be arguing on his behalf. I'm asking the court to affirm the lower court's grant of summary judgment and award of damages and prejudgment interest in this case because the trial court correctly interpreted the insurance contract at issue here in its determination of the definition of in the open, or the word open, finding that that exclusion in this policy did not apply to my client's loss, which occurred on September 22nd of 2000.
Let me ask you a question, sort of follow up the first question I asked of your opposing counsel, and that is, and if you just cover it with newspaper, would you consider that? It's in the open. We all agree it's in the open in the sense that it's not within a permanent structure. I'm not sure that's really a problem, but the question is on sufficiency of protection. If you just covered it with, let's say what you had. You covered it with a tarp. The tarp, I think the testimony was, had some, or there's something, had some tears in it.
I believe it, his testimony was in prior times he had noticed some tears in it and that they had repackaged it, if you will.
Right, and he had wrapped it and put some cedar cinder blocks at some place and some stuff to try to weight it down.
Correct. They were 100-pound blocks. And
clearly that wasn't enough to keep it on for the storm you had, which is pretty substantial.
That's correct.
Do you think, though, that the level of protection it has is an issue in this case?
I don't think it's an issue in this case, Judge, because, again, I think, as you described earlier, I think what we want to look at is what are we trying to protect from, and in this case is the rain, and an industrial tarp will provide that protection. Now, unfortunately, the policies, and I'm not aware of insurance policies that discuss the level of protection needed. What if we had it in a tent? We had a tent out there with sides on the tent. Then you're talking about, you know, is that adequate protection?
If you had to tear down the whole length of the tarp, would you consider that adequate?
Prior to the event?
Prior to the event. In other words, your client was trying to find a tarp. He found a tarp. The tarp is torn, has a long gash in it. But since he doesn't have another tarp at the time, you know, the intention is to go out and get another tarp. But I don't have another tarp. This is the best I have right now. You put that on there. Would you consider that protection adequate?
I think if he attempted to cover it with that tarp as best he could, I think that would be considered to be protection, adequate protection under this policy. I agree because, again, the term that they're attempting to define in their favor is in the open, and it doesn't address the adequacy of the protection. Again,
Go ahead. Finish your thought.
It could be a tent, or what if it was a building, but it was a building that was 110 years old that was a bad structure. So I think that's kind of a red herring in this. It's regarding the adequacy of protection. I think we're looking at, you know, was it in the open as defined in this policy?
But you know, in the scope of, you know, worldwide experience, isn't it an inherently greater risk of damage from rain if property is left outdoors, no matter how well it's covered, than if it's kept inside of building? Putting aside your 110-year-old whatever that's...
I don't believe it's inherently more at risk if it's properly covered with industrial tarp versus being in a building with respect to a storm of this magnitude, okay?
Would you rather be under a tarp in a storm of such a magnitude, or would you rather be in a building?
Get stimulus funds.
I'd rather be in a building, Your Honor.
Okay, that's it. You've conceded your case.
But I think that, again, we're... I was in a building last night when the storm came through Chicago, and I'm from Southern Illinois, which we've been out without electricity for a week. Anyway, back to the issue. The court, again, we're looking at interpreting this concept of in the open, and as the state Supreme Court has said, is, you know, we need to look at the intent of the parties here. And if you look at this and look at the policy as a whole, well, let's look what my client purchased. He purchased an open peril policy, which used to be called an all-risk policy. They've changed the term a couple of times, but it basically covers everything unless it's excluded or limited in some way.
He paid a premium for that, and that's, you can find that actually in the record. It shows the amount of premiums he paid, which were quite substantial. And third, he reported this inventory, both outside and inside, on monthly reporting forms to the insurance company, because his premium fluctuated up and down depending on the nature of his or the quantity of his inventory. So clearly the intent both of my client and the insurance company was to cover this inventory with the policy because of the, you know, those items show us what that intent is.
Given that he was unable to quantify his damages, let's go, during his deposition, why wasn't he obliged in his affidavit to explain why he was now able to put a number on his damages and to set forth, you know, his methodology?
Two things, Judge. At his deposition, he was only asked if he had an estimate of his claim or the amount of his loss, and he said he was reluctant to come up with a number, so he said, I don't have an estimate, because at that time he had not made a calculation.
He gave a number, though.
Pardon?
He gave a number, though, in his deposition. Didn't he say around $60,000, around $60,000, I thought?
I don't believe he did, Your Honor, that he actually gave a number.
Hey, well, I made the mistake, and I thought he'd given a number.
If he did, it was, again, just off the, you know, a ballpark figure, because obviously under his affidavit, he came up with a calculation based on the amount of wood that was damaged by the rain, which was a calculation simply by going out and counting the number. You know, these were huge piles of finished wood products. They were, you know, not quite a 2x4, say a 1x2 that were finished products. So he needed to separate the damaged product from the undamaged product.
But Judge Baumbachlin is absolutely correct that he previously had testified that he didn't know whether the damaged property was more than $60,000.
Okay. And thank you, Your Honor. I think that was in response to a question put by him by counsel, yes. And at that time, he didn't have an estimate because he had not separated the good from the bad. And that's what he did in preparation of the affidavit. With regard to the damages that he set forth in his affidavit, I don't believe he has to put every calculation that he came up with as far in his affidavit. Now, and if he was required to, counsel for the other party should have filed an objection or motion to strike indicating it was insufficient in some way. There was no question that the affidavit was not raised as to the sufficiency of the affidavit itself, so it was admissible, and it was based on his knowledge as the owner of that product. In Illinois, an owner of their own property are qualified to testify as to the value of their own property.
Aren't damages, though, generally, unless the parties agree to them, a question of fact?
I would agree if there was a question of fact before the court, but there was no counter affidavit filed. There was no other evidence other than some general language regarding an estimate of his damages in his deposition testimony. I don't believe that creates a question of fact, because it was an unequivocal statement as to how much he thought he lost when his affidavit was taken in August of 2007.
Well, this was 2.5 years ago also, so how today would you find what the damages were?
He went out and
I mean, if you had to start right now,
if the product was still there, we would
go.
Yeah,
well, the product isn't there anymore, is it?
Yeah, we would separate the good from the bad, add up the number of boards that were damaged by the rain, and take that by the fair market value of those boards, multiply those numbers together, and come up, and that's what he did to come up with the $81,000 figure. So that's how you would do it today, is the same as he did it.
But to follow up, that product's not there anymore.
I'm sorry?
That product's not there anymore, is it?
No, it's not.
I mean, if you start today determining what the loss was, you couldn't base the loss on what was there at the time of the damage, because it's not there.
That is correct. And that's one of the issues with regard to their argument of damages. They never adjusted this claim. The adjuster went out one time, right, as the deposition testimony showed, took some pictures, left, and never returned. They weren't concerned with the amount of damages because they were asserting that it was excluded under the policy, which obviously we disputed. But even after the dispute arose, Jester only went out there one time. So I think that, you know, they bear some responsibility for not making that effort to themselves to adjust that.
Now, the court made no finding of bad faith or anything else that would have justified a higher rate of prejudgment interest. So how do you respond to the argument that the district court erred in awarding the presumptive statutory rate of 5%.
Judge, I don't think it was an abuse of discretion from the court because he kind of indicates to us what his belief is when he indicates that Mr. Twenhoffel paid his premiums, did what he was supposed to under this policy, and didn't get what he got. He didn't receive fair value in exchange for him complying with his part of the policy. And the fact that the, you know, I believe it's implied in the court's opinion when he said Mr. Twenhoffel paid his premium and the insurance company should pay for what he for what they sold to him. And I believe that meant to pay him promptly on his claim.
But to get higher in the statutory rate, you had to find some sort of vexatious conduct on part of the insurance company. And the only thing that they really did was they contested the claim. They contested the claim in using the exclusion provision in the open, whatever that means. And but that was they challenged it on that basis. The court, to follow up, the court never made an independent factual finding of any kind of vexatious conduct except awarding interest above the statutory rate.
That's correct, Judge. Made no specific factual findings in the judgment order. Again, I believe it's based on that the court believed, and interpreting from his order, that it was improper for them to claim that this property was excluded under the term in the open, especially in light of the Victory Peach case, although, as the court is aware, there was only two cases that are even closely similar to this. If you look clearly or closely at the Victory Peach case, I believe you'll find that that policy is identical to this policy. The terms, even the subsection numbers, are the same as this, subsection numbers in this policy. And I think the court basically said this was not a proper exclusion. They should have never raised it, and they should have adjusted the claim and paid my client because he paid the premium for this open peril policy. And that was the reason he gave us the enhanced, I believe he gave us the enhanced interest, but I agree, there's no specific factual finding in that respect. So, you know, based on the lower court's decision, we're asking this court to affirm the summary judgment granted by Judge Murphy in favor of my client, Roger Twenhoffel, and against the State Auto in the amount of the damages as well as the prejudgment interest. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. And the case will be taken under advisement.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.